really in tune with it, so that's
good. Do you get to choose the film? Is there
good morning. Welcome to the Conference on World Affairs, Day 2, Boulder Campus. This is the panel on religious diversity, so if that's not your intended destination, you can deplane now before we close the doors. It's a great pleasure to have you here with us. As a moderator, I've been asked to read the following statement. In this CWA session, we will utilize both the CWA app and a note card system to receive questions from the audience. To ask a question in the app, simply select the session schedule, tap live Q&A, and then insert your question. You may also raise your hand at any time to request a note card and pencil from one of our producers. One of them is here right now. Then give your question to the producer. If you're a student, please note this in your question as we give priorities to students. Questioners who would like to verbalize their question can note this in the text, include your name, and if I select your question, I will recognize you and invite you to the microphone. And this is my first time using the app, too, as a moderator, so I'll do my best to try to make this work. Very pleased to have a very distinguished panel here this morning. I'll begin by introducing myself, which I'm supposed to do. I am Stuart Hoover. I'm a professor of media studies and religious studies here at the University of Colorado, and I direct the university's Center on Media, Religion, and Culture. So this is an area that I'm obviously quite interested in, and as I speak and do research around the world, it's become obvious to me, more and more obvious all the time, that religion has not gone away. In fact, religion has persisted in the 21st century, in spite of what my sociology professor on the undergraduate social course told me. It was a residual category, and by the time you are where I am, religion will have just disappeared entirely. And of course, that has not happened. And it's one of the fundamental realities of modernity. Since the age of exploration, the ways those of us in the North Atlantic West have understood cultural diversity has been through religion, and it continues to be the case. And that used to be an academic matter, but now it's becoming a social and cultural matter, and it's increasingly felt on the ground here in North America and in Europe. And so we have four distinguished panelists who are going to help us think through the implications of this. I will ask you, if you want to know more about their biographies, to consult the program book. I will only introduce very briefly who they are, identify them, and then they're going in a slightly different order than in the program book, and I'll explain that as well. Our panelists are Willow Wilson. Willow is a novelist and comic book author and a speaker. Stephen Vertovec. Stephen is an alumnus of the Religious Studies Department here at the University of Colorado, but is now director of the Max Planck Institute for the Study of Religious and Ethnic Diversity. Next to me, Frank Strasburger. Frank is a former Episcopal chaplain at Princeton University and is a convert from Judaism to Christianity, he just told me. And then Josh Larson, co-host of WBEZ's Film Spotting and editor of Think Christian. And we're going to go in the following order. Steve will start, followed by Willow, followed by Josh, and followed by Frank. And I will not do further introductions. So, Steve, would you like to begin?
Thanks very much. Good morning, everybody. Great that you're here, especially on such a beautiful day. Take on religious diversity, I'll say straight off, is mainly going to be about what we can call constructed religious diversity. That is, societies that have built up diversity over the years through immigration, particularly. This is opposed to numerous societies throughout the world, throughout history, that have been multi-religious forever, African societies, many Asian societies, and so forth. The dynamics there, which we might want to get onto, are different, I think, from societies like the USA, or especially be talking about places like Great Britain, that the religiously diverse configuration has been built up over years and years of immigration from different parts of the world. And I think that makes a difference in the way that religious diversity can be understood and approached. And I want to talk, I'll talk no more than 10 minutes, first about what I will call something like religious diversity from the inside. What are the effects within religions? And then religious diversity from the outside, that is how state and society has approached religious diversity. And I hope there's some themes that will be picked up by some of the colleagues on the panel too. Okay, so I'm mainly talking about societies. I lived for 25 years in the UK, in Great Britain. Now I live in Germany. But a lot of the issues I'll talk about are the same here. That is, in the UK, UK is different from the US in that there's an official state religion, the Anglican Church. The Queen is actually the head of the church. And so that has to be understood, that there is a kind of official framework as opposed to the U.S. where it's highly secular, that the state has nothing to do with religion. In any case, in the U.K. over the years, through immigration, Muslims from Pakistan and Bangladesh, Hindus and Buddhists from India, Rastafarians and other kinds of Caribbean religion from the West Indies, Chinese religions from China, and in more recent decades, various forms of Eastern Christianity coming from Eastern Europe. And so what are the effects from within side of religion? What's the effects for a Muslim coming to the UK or growing up in, a, as it were, a transplanted religion? And what I especially want to point to, and what we've looked at through research, I'm an anthropologist, and so a lot of what I'm saying is research-based. One of the key things that religious diversity does, especially if you're coming from, let's say, Pakistan, a Muslim majority country, to a place where suddenly you are a minority in your religion, and one thing it does on the inside is suddenly create a situation of critical self-reflection. Our religion versus all of those, or especially in a place where you have a state religion as well. And as this, as it were, minority religion gets passed on through generations, that critical reflection also turns to the point, what do I teach my kids? It's different when you're in a Muslim majority country where it's all around you and your kids can absorb it in those sorts of ways or directly through school. If you're a minority, you have to think, what are the key tenets I want to teach my kid? And for the kids themselves, this critical reflection has led to as it were, a disentangling of religion and culture. That is, let's stick with Pakistani Muslims, the example for a minute. There have been all sorts of critical self-reflection, say summer camps set up for young Muslim kids, where they're actually taught about the tenets of Islam, and the kids can often go back and tell their parents, sorry, what you're trying to get me to do, that's just Pakistani culture, this is Islam. And the same goes for Hindus, the same goes for lots of Christian varieties as well. So this disentangling of culture and religion and this critical self-reflection is some of the effects of what happens on the inside of religions when you're suddenly in a highly diverse context. That's just the one set of thought points to put out there we can discuss later on. From the outside now, a lot of immigration societies, like the U.S., of course, are faced with the task, okay, how, in order to promote religious freedom of various kinds, how do we accommodate other religions that are transplanted into a place where they haven't been before? And there are various ways that states have done this, obviously through laws, and particularly through anti-discrimination laws, allowing religious freedom. Often on the city level, cities making deals, as it were, with leaders of religious organizations to allow building permits and cemeteries and perhaps provision of certain types of food in schools. Sometimes groups have called for their own schools, and this becomes a point of real debate for states of how to accommodate. Do we allow that or not? So there are various ways that states have helped diversity flourish by making certain kinds of allowances. I would say that is the important way forward, and it's a great way of allowing religious freedom. The one downside of that, though, is often these kind of state accommodations made by way of group rights can underpin and continuously reproduce what anthropologists call groupist thinking. That is, putting forward an idea that basically all Hindus think and believe the same thing, all Muslims think and believe the same thing, all Eastern Christians believe and think the same thing. And that is, of course, not the case. And that can actually really lead to what we call kind of religious racisms as well. Or, you know, you hear a lot about Islamophobia in the media these days. So that's a kind of conundrum, to allow group rights and to make group accommodations. But as I say, that can lead to groupist thinking about things. And as I say, especially for young people, that's a contentious and a difficult thing. I'll just give one example. I live in Germany now, and I remember listening to a radio program where they had teenagers from different faith groups on a kind of panel like this. And I thought that was a good thing, getting young people in there, getting religious diversity up front. But then they would ask questions like to a young Muslim person, so why does your religion treat women in such and such a way? And this kid would just be like, I don't know. And but this type of idea was that, well, they all kind of share the same thing. They all know the same things. They all have the same modes of practice and understanding of religion. That's what I mean by this kind of groupist thinking. Or, I have to say, in some of the public discourse in the U.S. about terrorism, thinking that the Muslim community knows what's going on out there is a terrible mode of groupist thinking about religious minorities as well. But you see what I mean? It kind of goes hand in hand with making group rights and group accommodations, which is an important thing that states need to do, but you also need to change the discourse to understand, and this will be my final point, diversity within diversity. That there's a great variety of understandings, of faiths, of modes of practice, of modes of understanding within any religious group. And you cannot treat them as if they are all the same type of Hindu or Muslim or Christian. So that's the kind of what I mean from inside and outside. So I think that's my final point. Let's try to advocate a kind of public discourse recognizing not only religious freedom, but that freedom goes down to the individual level, not just being stuck on the group level, that individual religious diversity is something we have to keep in mind at all times.
Thank you, Steve, for that, to get us started. I'd like to talk a little bit about intra-religious diversity, which is something that Steve touched on, the diversity that occurs within religions, in addition to the diversity of religions within a particular geographical area. And I'd like to start out with a bit of an anecdote. About 8 or 9 years ago, I was asked to fill in writing Superman, comic book series. The main writer was ill and had fallen behind, and I had been asked to write a couple of issues to give him some time to catch up. And given what Superman sort of means to us as a culture, as a cultural icon, there were certain groups of people kind of on the right wing who were very upset that a Muslim woman had been allowed to write this series for 2 issues or what have you. And I got the most interesting piece of hate mail I have ever gotten in my life. So interesting that I've saved it. And now it's very difficult to get into my inbox. Now if you want to get into my inbox, you have to go through one of my agents, which has really cut down on the threats, but also on these interesting pieces of mail that I used to get. So this thing landed in my inbox, and each line was a different color. You know, like the first line was red and then purple and then brown and orange and green. I mean, somebody had put a lot of effort into making this thing pretty. But it accused me in the first line of being part of the socialist homosexual Muslim attack on American values. And I was like, wow. I don't know what that is, but it sounds fantastic. I mean, it was so farcical that it was self-caricaturing. I was like, who would come up with this constellation of ideas? This is the most nonsensical grouping I have ever heard of in my life. At the time, this was, let's see, not shortly after 9/11, but certainly in the midst of the Iraq War and in the aftermath of 9/11, the conversation in the American Muslim community had kind of shrunk to a couple of sides. There were sort of three prominent modalities in American Muslim thinking where politics were concerned. First, it's important to note that the largest community of Muslims in the United States is and has always been the African American Muslim community. They have been here since before there was anything called America. Up to a third of the slaves brought from Africa were of Muslim descent from various West African countries. And they have developed their own very specific, very particular narrative about what it means to be Muslim and what it means to be black in America. So they had their community, and there was not a lot of effort on behalf of immigrant Muslim communities from more recent waves of immigration to reach out to the African American community. They were sort of in their own space in this conversation. And within the Muslim communities that are more familiar to the American mainstream, immigrant communities from the Arab world, from South Asia, India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, there was a bit of a split. Before 9/11, Muslims were generally considered a very safe Republican demographic because there were certain areas of overlap between the conservative, traditional immigrant Muslim communities and conservative, traditional Christian right-wing politics. And the thought was kind of very simply, you're not into gay marriage, we're not into gay marriage. You're not into abortion, we're not into abortion. Match made in heaven. So prior to 9/11, Muslims almost across the board in America would vote Republican. Then, of course, 9/11 happened, and they found themselves thrown out of the club into which they had been so assiduously trying to get. And that changed the dynamic a little bit. And so the community began to split. You had traditionalists who were very socially conservative, very concerned with not just literal, but very particular kinds of readings of traditional Islamic texts, who were very adamant about traditional gender roles and things of that nature, who would, if they had their, you know, if they had their druthers, would vote Republican, but could not, in good conscience, vote for a party that had gone to war in Iraq. And on the other side, you had a wing that was sort of purportedly progressive. But what it really meant like that was it was, for many people, very on board with the project of the war in Iraq. They were Iraq war apologists, and quite secular. And sort of the idea there was that you can't really be a religious Muslim and, you know, in order to integrate, you had to sort of sip your Pinot Noir and, you know, give up your traditional clothing and sort of ape this line that sort of to be a good person from any religion, all you really have to do is be a good person according to you, and none of the other stuff matters. And you know, sort of this late capitalist woo that has sort of replaced religion in a lot of segments. And there was really nothing in the middle. There really wasn't a whole lot of room for people who thought that the particularities of belief, the particularities of practice, still have meaning and are still relevant, and yet at the same time, we're becoming more socially progressive. We're interested in making alliances with other groups. We're not on board with the war in Iraq or any sort of these late imperial wars. It was a sort of a difficult place to be. I and a lot of my friends sort of found ourselves in that spot. We thought that religion was something that was important. We were not of the sort of Pinot Noir sipping, it's all one kind of crowd, nor at the same time were we willing to sort of stay on board with this very regressive kind of Saudi-influenced literalist community that was on the other side. And we were kind of orphaned. And things went on, and time went by, and it was clear that the youth, I'm 34, and I'm thinking right now of people who are now in their late teens and early 20s and mid-20s, for them, things like gay rights were a given. That genie was not going back in the bottle. Once you know that certain people are human in the same way that you are human, and you want for them not only equal rights, but the same chance at happiness and success, that clock doesn't go back. And so for those kids, it was a matter of reconciling, okay, these things are important to me, but I am also proud of my faith. This is something that grounds me. I'm not willing to just ditch all of that. I'm not willing to accept that in order to be American, I have to essentially make myself as much like a, you know, upper middle class white guy as I possibly can. And along came this election cycle. And all of a sudden, everything that we thought we knew about what it was to be an American, not just what it was to be an American Muslim, was thrown into doubt. And it was clear at that point to all of the people who had maybe hoped that one day we could rejoin the ranks of the Republicans and be part of the religious right and go back to all of this, that hope was shattered. They knew that they were never getting back into that club. And so the people who were sort of from that point of view found themselves increasingly marginalized. These are generally older folks within the community who had sort of been the community leaders for a long time, and everything was upset. And all of a sudden, the people who were at the forefront of the community defining what it was to be an American Muslim were young people. And they wanted to go to the Women's March. And all of a sudden, you could say the words Islamic feminism or Muslim feminists and not be kicked out of the mosque, and in fact be invited to the mosque to speak. And there were all of a sudden people finding these historical efforts at accommodation for people who did not fit traditional gender roles or gender expectations, people who might have been intersex, people who were transgender. There were these massive efforts to kind of reread texts in light of modern realities, while at the same time refusing to demonize religiosity itself. In other words, this is not a secular movement. It was one very much rooted in spirituality and in centering Islamic practice in one's own life. And so I woke up shortly before the election, or shortly after the election, I should say, and people from my local mosque were going to the Women's March and standing side by side with feminist groups and with gay rights groups. And I said, my God, these socialist homosexual Muslim attack on American values is here. It's real. And so now I feel like, on some level, with a certain amount of irony, that I have to thank the alt-right and the extreme right wing, because the things that they were afraid of, the groups that they thought that they could isolate and humiliate individually, have now formed common cause. And there wasn't a socialist homosexual Muslim attack on American values before. But now the socialist homosexual Muslims are the ones defending American values. So I have to say thank you to the right wing. I never thought it was possible, and it wouldn't have been without your help.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Willow, and thanks for everyone for giving us your time this morning. We're moving towards a theme, it seems, so I'll continue in that track, and then we can completely abandon it later, and when we get to questions, if you'd care to. But this was something I had been thinking about as well, this idea of groupist thinking that Steve talked about, and intra-religious diversity. There is diversity within diversity when it comes to religion, and I think even my instinct when I saw the title of this panel, Religious Diversity, was, what am I going to say about world religions? I have no background in that. That's where we go. But really, we have to bore down before we can even get to that point and consider this diversity within diversity. So I will just speak from my own experience. I'm here wearing different hats, as I do every day, as the editor of Think Christian. I'm very much involved in the dialogue of a particular expression of Christianity. And the people who come to be a part of that conversation, where we explore culture, what's going on in the news, cultural artifacts, movies, whatever it might be, those people come from different expressions of Christianity as well. So at the same time I do that all day, at night I play film critic, and that is for a mainstream audience. The radio program that I do in the podcast, Film Spotting, we speak to film fans of all different backgrounds. And so it's an interesting perspective to have a foot in both of those worlds and see how they relate and to see how people respond when they find out that's where I'm standing. Because there's often confusion. Well, how can you do both? Or really what's under that question is, how can you let people know that you do this mainstream media project and you're also doing a Christian media project? Usually you have to choose, right? So that is my particular place. So I have a unique individual expression of Christianity, as does everyone else who follows whatever religion they have chosen to follow. And I think that we sometimes forget that, and the groupist thinking does come into play. And these things get heightened, of course, when we are in an election year, when there is something that forces us to start categorizing in order to try to understand. Because once things get too diffuse and we can't grasp onto them, we just want to stop thinking about it. We need categories. We need things that we know, people we know, and we can pigeonhole them in certain places and then predict their responses. And that all blew up in our faces with this last election. I can talk particularly from my experience of seeing what happened within expressions of Christianity, and not just the election of Trump with the large support of evangelicals, but really at the same time that we're experiencing the decline of American Christendom. And part of that reality led to a certain panic, a wanting to reclaim it. But at the same time, it was also an opportunity for other expressions of Christianity. And this is the dialogue that we saw taking place at Think Christian, where it was a shedding of this Christian republicanism, or Republican Christianity, whichever way you want to look at it, and especially younger generations, which saw there's another way. There is not this set in stone path that needs to be followed if you call yourself a Christian, that contradicts some of the things that I'm starting to come to believe as I think about these things as an individual. But at the same time, as Willow was mentioning, there's a new expression that does not then reject their faith that they've grown up with because of that. They want to find a way to hold to that tradition, hold to those sincere beliefs, the practices as well that you mentioned, which are very important to young Christians, yet not necessarily have to take that whole package that really has governed American culture and political culture in a lot of ways for the previous century. So I think that understanding there are these divisions, there's this diversity within, you know, I'm just speaking to Christianity, but Willow has obviously shown that similar things are happening with American Muslims, that then we can start building up towards a place where big religious diversity actually has a chance. So in some ways, there's a lot of work to do.
I'm going to begin with a kind of simple-minded observation. If religion, and I think this is true of just about all religion, is an attempt to get a handle on the infinite, then by definition, all religion is at least a little bit wrong. So diversity is absolutely essential. Because every religion needs a corrective somehow. Some religion may be a lot wrong. The problem is that we as finite beings have trouble telling which is which. And so the corrective from outside is necessary. Many of you may be familiar with the story in Exodus of Moses and the burning bush. God comes to Moses out of a burning bush and tells him to lead the people of Israel out of Egypt. And Moses quite naturally says to God, "Who shall I tell him sent me?" And God says, "God." And Moses says, "Yeah, but you know, what's your name?" And God, in essence, says to Moses, "You can't name me." He just says, "I am," which is for Moses a pretty unsatisfactory answer. In fact, it's a pretty unsatisfactory answer for the rest of us, but it's what we get. If we're after the infinite, we can't name God. We can't put a frame around him, but that's just what all religions do because we're human beings, because we have to have a way to talk about the infinite. And so down through the ages, we've found lots of ways to try to do that. And what we forget is that as we construct metaphors, because that's the best we can do to try to do that, we ourselves forget that the metaphors are metaphors and start to take them literally. And before you know it, we're at each other's throats because our metaphors are different and we think we're talking about totally different things. So let me tell a little parable. Tom and Helen, friends for a long time, decide to go to an art museum. And they go together, but as often happens among friends or even married couples who go to places like art museums, they immediately split up because they don't like the same kind of art. So Tom goes off to the left down the hall and up three flights of stairs and walking down the third floor hall and gets to one of those velvet ropes they always have in museums. And he looks into this enormous space and hanging from the ceiling is an absolutely incredible sculpture. He's never seen anything like it. It has all these great angles, purples and reds and blues, and he looks at it, he's dumbfounded, and then he thinks, oh my gosh, Ellen has got to see this. And so he goes racing down the stairs to find Helen. Helen, meanwhile, has gone down to the right, gone up the stairs, and she's come down the third floor hall, and she gets stopped by a blue velvet rope and looks into this incredible space. You guys can finish this story. You know where I'm going. She looks at this sculpture, and she sees all these wonderful curves and greens and oranges and just something like she's never seen. She goes racing down to tell Tom. Now, obviously, these guys have been looking at the same sculpture. It's not the sculpture's fault that their vision can't get around. It's their limitation. And Tom will sit there and tell Helen, no, 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 my sculpture is the really incredible one. You got to come. You got to come this way. That's how we deal with stuff that is bigger than we can describe, bigger than we can understand. We keep forgetting as we talk about God that even in saying God, we're talking about something way beyond any of us can get our hands on. All we see is a little bit. And so that diversity is essential to remind us of that fact. Because one of the problems with any single religion is it tends to talk to itself. I gave a talk a couple of weeks ago. I do a great deal of work in Africa. And I gave a talk in the parish I attend. I'm now retired. And one of the questions was, how come all the work you're doing, none of the work you're doing in Africa has anything to do with the church? And my immediate response was, because the church spends all its time talking to itself. And I want to get out there and talk to everybody, be talked to by everybody. Stuart mentioned I'm a convert from Judaism to Christianity. There are two kinds of converts. They're the ones that suddenly see the light and insist that you have to see the same light they see. And then there are the converts who remember who they've always been And I've never forgotten what it was like before I became a Christian, and remember that there was a lot of stuff there that I missed. And so, you know, I am religious diversity, so naturally, you know, I take this this stance. I'm also an Episcopalian. And anybody, are there any Episcopalians in the room? Raise your hands. A few. Episcopalians are people, I mean, Episcopalians haven't agreed with each other in 500 years. We say the creed at every service. But if you went down the line and asked each person, what did you mean by that? You'd get as many answers as people. So we're just full of religious diversity, but we forget it. And so we do the very groupism that Steve was talking about. When we talk to other people, we see them monolithically, whether it's Muslims or Jews, or I used to get very frustrated about the fact that since Hasidic Jews are among the best writers in Judaism, you know, many non-Jews have read novels like The Promise and The Chosen and My Name is Asher Lev, all written by a Hasidic author, and begin to think that all Jews are Hasidic Jews. That's a tiny segment of Judaism. So we get these sort of glimpses of other religion, and we think that's it. To me, all of life, human life, everybody's human life, is about beginning to reach out to and embrace the other. Some of us never do it, and we get cut off in that journey. But if that's the journey, to reach out and embrace the other, that's kind of the recognition that we're just surrounded by diversity. We needn't be afraid of it. We actually can celebrate it, because it's what enables us to become the people we are.
Thank you very much. Our speakers have very generously allowed quite a bit of time for discussion and conversation with them and between them. I'd like to just encourage those of you who have questions either to raise your hands, get a card from the producers, or send something to me using the app. But first, I always like to begin these conversations by asking the panel if they have any questions they'd like to put to each other after having heard each other's thoughts. So we'll allow a moment for that.
Yeah, I'd love to hear from Willow, you know, when you talked about the parades and these various groups coming together for a common cause, can you talk a little bit about the reception of a religious group by those who are already there, what that experience maybe has been a bit like?
It's been phenomenal. I think I took my two daughters, who are 4 and 6, so quite young, to the march in Seattle, which was one of the big ones, not as big as the one in Denver. So you guys rolled it out. because I wanted them to be able to say, my mom took me to this. And it was astonishing. I mean, I've never seen anything like that before. It was really the sense of solidarity, the sense of we have to start by being good to each other if we want to fix this, was just so strong. At one point I was trying to navigate that. I mean, it was a giant, giant crowd down the street from our house. We just walked there. And so at one point I was trying to sort of help my kids down this little embankment, and a priest in a cassock came up and helped us get down. And so it was just, it was incredible. It was really amazing. And, you know, that's not to say that this whole thing has been without conflict and without debate, because I think, you know, once it gets down to, okay, we need to create a platform that we can all get behind, and also listen to the grievances of some groups which have been ignored for a long time, and have, you know, a lot of bottled up storytelling that the nation has not heard. And so you know, there's a lot of ways to get at cross purposes, but I think fundamentally it felt to me like a sea change. We'll see if it holds, but it was definitely a real shift in my mind.
I'd like to ask my fellow panelists to their views on a particular concept that's often advocated as the real way forward for dealing with the context of religious diversity, and that's tolerance. We should all have religious tolerance. And I'll just put my cards on the table. I'm a bit iffy about the notion of tolerance, because I always bear in mind what I heard a lesbian activist saying one time, that tolerance is the word you use when talking about your neighbor's barking dog. That it's something that you're really not very good with, but you're going to just let it go. And I don't think that's good enough as a way forward. I think something like recognition and obviously respect is a way forward. But what are your views on the tolerance thing?
Yeah, I think that's not a helpful word. It's one, you know, we at Think Christian have common threads, and that's where we start to hear a lot of different perspectives, and that word will be thrown out as a way forward. And I think it's really a mask for exclusion. It's a polite way to exclude and to say, we're just going to close the door on you now. So that's been my experience.
Yeah, I tolerance is going up to the 50-yard line, but not beyond. It's exactly the same as peaceful coexistence. There are many people in this room who remember that. What the way forward is engaging each other, and tolerance has no room for engagement. I the one thing I'll just disagree with you about, Josh, I don't think tolerance is a polite word.
Okay, we do have some questions from the audience, and I'll start with, where do you see the growing push to break down the separation of church and state in the U.S. heading?
Well, I'll respond to that. I think the church has spent a lot of time shooting itself in the foot. Because the church has been the genesis of so much intolerance, if I can use that, I think in many ways the church has been responsible for creating a kind of backlash, an increasingly secular movement. I think we're headed towards something that I believe the founders actually really intended, which is not non-religion, but room for all religion and non-religion. Because we are a country that is increasingly diverse, in which people of color are about to be the majority, and in which there is so much so much stuff coming in, we're going to have to make room for it. I think what's happening right now is a lot of fear that the old order is passing. Well, there should be. It is. But there isn't that much to be afraid of. And I think as people become more comfortable. I've not lived in California, but people I know that do live in California say, hey, get used to it. It works. We're fine. We'll live. And I think as people become more comfortable, people will begin to revert to what was there in the first place in the separation of church and state.
I would like to think it could be rejuvenating. I'm not sure what's behind the question. I mean, this is so thorny. You could go a million different directions. whose separation of church and state are you talking about, and what are they looking for? But if we do proceed towards a more distinct hardline separation between church and state, I think for the, this goes back to what I was saying about American Christendom, for those who have experienced the power of that separation, if that goes away, it might make faith something they have to think about more and take seriously. It's not just the air that's being breathed. It's not tied to their income. It's not tied to their influence. And then perhaps it'll become something that's personal, and they'll have to ask, why really do I believe this? Or maybe the question before that, do I really believe this? And if the answer is still yes, then it can become something that that means something and is not just a tradition or a way they happen to live.
I want to combine two questions that have come in that have to do with the issue of diversity and the way that religious organizations and religious traditions kind of stage the problem or the challenge to diversity. One questioner asked, don't we need religious leaders and religious figures and religious writers, et cetera, to focus on the things that are similar between faiths? Another writer points out that there can be said to be direct contradictions between the sacred texts of certain faiths, the most fundamental of which is that some texts claim to be universalistic. That is, we are the universal faith and all other faiths are wrong. So how does the idea of tradition, the idea of the sacred writings and religious leadership, what kind of position or what kind of role do they play in this problem of diversity and question of diversity?
I think leaders, it really depends. I think leaders means a different thing depending on what faith you're talking about. You know, you have religions like Catholicism in which there's a fairly set hierarchy, and then you have, evangelicals where you can kind of found your own church in a more or less willy-nilly fashion, and you have Islam in which there is no priesthood and it's all kind of very anarchic. Which has upsides, which is, you know, there's nobody to sort of consolidate power and kick out everybody that they don't like. And on the other hand, there's nobody to tell the people who are doing bad things, guess what, you're out of the club. So I think that really varies depending on what faith tradition you're talking about. But this raises an issue that I thought was interesting. I think we conflate theology and ethics often when we talk about religion in a way that is unhelpful. Ethically, I think religions are pretty much a wash. You know, like any religion that had said it's okay to murder your neighbor, neglect your crops, and just sort of let your children run in the forests and be eaten by wolves would not last very long. You know, it's so ethically, I think the vast majority of faiths come to very similar conclusions because it's essentially, you know, how do we live in the world? How do we not sow chaos? How do we increase our own prosperity and wealth and live with other people. Theologically, they're very different. Obviously, it's pretty hard to reconcile, a polytheistic religion with a monotheistic one, or sometimes even more, even more importantly, within a religion, those fights are sometimes the bloodiest. I mean, I'll never forget reading Umberto Eco, the famous Italian Catholic novelist and linguist, who's describing a period of time in the Middle Ages where these two monastic orders fought each other to the death over the question of whether or not Jesus laughed. So sometimes those conflicts can be the bloodiest of all. So, you know, I think what we're really going to see going forward is an entire rethinking of what role religion itself plays in the 21st century, which might create unique opportunities, I think, for interreligious dialogue that may not have existed before, because the question is no longer, did Jesus laugh? Is Jesus still important? And that, I think, is something that will really strike home across religious boundaries as people start to wrestle with, what does religion mean in an age where its social necessity is no longer there. In an age where we can basically do on Kickstarter what had been done in churches for, you know, 2,000 years prior to that, in terms of supporting each other financially and that kind of thing. So that, I think, is going to be the big question.
I'd like to talk about the writings, because that was sort of the second half of that question, or maybe a different related question. Quite frequently, we see the contradictions between the writings of our own faith, the contradictions with those of another faith, assuming that what we're talking about in the writings of the other faith, which we don't know very well, are appropriate reflections on those writings. And one of the things I'm thinking about is how frequently one hears, even in the and sees even in the press, how violent the Quran is. And it's always out of a Christian mouth, and I just wonder whether that person ever read the Bible. Because the Bible is an extraordinarily violent text. In a couple of nights, we Christians at the Easter Vigil will read a text about, with great rejoicing, because God has thrown the charioteers and their riders into the sea, thereby making it possible for the Israelites to escape through across the Red Sea. I and a lot of other people like me have a little problem with that. That text says poor charioteers were just operating at the behest of the Pharaoh. Why does God take it out on them? The writings within, we're back to this whole business of intra-religious diversity. The writings of each religion are internally contradictory. And again, they can't help but be because they're trying to get at the infinite. And also because they reflect an evolution of human understanding of the infinite over thousands of years. I don't know about you, I don't understand it very well, and it's not very surprising to me that people 2,000 or 3,000 years ago didn't quite get it. So we just have to stand back a little bit, make room for the fact that we've all got this same problem with the writings, and we need to do a whole lot better work at unpacking those writings. You know, one of the things, the Gospel of John is the most apparently triumphalist of the Christian Gospels, the one that says no one gets to God but through Christ. That's a little tough for you, right? It's a little tough for my family, my Jewish family. But he's the only one of the four evangelists who says that. And he's the last. So there are three other gospels that don't say that. But somehow we land on that and say, oh, well, you know, then you got to be Christian to be saved. We've got to unpack that stuff and take a good look at why the author of John wrote that, who he was writing for, and what he was really talking about. And did Jesus really say that? Probably not. So each of us in our own faith have a lot of work to do to make room for the diversity that's out there so that we're not all stuck with trying to defend something that's kind of indefensible.
Steve?
Yeah. I think all really good and inspirational what's said. I just want to point out some different religious leadership perspectives that have been taken, which I think are all worth bearing in mind as well. A lot of people don't know that within Islam, there's a whole branch of scholarship, medieval scholarship within Islam, about how to be a Muslim in a non-Muslim environment. This goes back a long way. And a lot of it has to do with what we now talk about, a separation between the public sphere and the private sphere. In the public sphere, you have to be a citizen of whatever that land or kingdom or empire. And, you know, sounds like the Jesus thing as well, you know, pay to Caesar what is due, and then that sort of thing. Sorry, no, I'm not good with scripture. So, you know, this leadership on how to deal with diversity goes back a long way. This is actually quite different from, I mean, I've done a lot of work with Hindu communities, and a lot of Hindu perspectives on this is, well, really, all these different religions, everybody's really a Hindu, you just don't know it. You know, so that's a different way to deal with religious diversity, where we encompass it all. But I'll just end the comment here with another nice perspective. People might have heard this, you know, Prince Charles in his long wait to become king. We'll see if he ever does. You know, the queen is officially leader of the faith, i.e. meaning Anglican Church, and Prince Charles says that if and when he becomes king, he wants to change that and be leader of the faiths. And that's another...
He's going to make himself caliph? Well, I mean, I'm into it. I don't know.
Well, I think that, you know, that is a potential future for the American Christian Church, is when you reference the early Christian Church of the New Testament, it was exactly as persecuted outsiders, and you know that's a hot term to use, and some people I think misuse the term persecution these days, especially if you compare it to that situation. But again, that goes back to the it's not, for me, it's not walling yourself off to the rest of the culture and the other religions that may exist in the pluralistic society you find yourself in, but it is realizing that you now have to take extremely seriously what you do believe, because it is not a given. It's, in a sense, yes, distressing for those who have felt comfortable for many decades, but can, I think, be rejuvenating.
I would just add, you talked about the early church. Given the poor communication around the Mediterranean, what we see in Paul's letters is that the early Christian church was quite diverse.
And argumentative.
Indeed, they were.
Okay, we have a couple of questions that focus on the Abrahamic traditions and their commonalities and their differences. One moves in that direction by asking, maybe it would be better if there was greater religious agreement rather than diversity. Wouldn't we all get along better? Another one sort of asking the question of whether, if we look at the three Abrahamic faiths, are the three Abrahamic faiths actually worshiping the same God?
Yeah.
Does that solve a problem for us?
I wonder about that. I mean, I think all of the three Abrahamic faiths have the commonality that, unlike the earlier sort of Mediterranean and Arabian polytheistic faiths, it's not mercantile. In other words, it's not you go to whatever land and then you worship the god that is worshipped in that land, and then you go somewhere else and worship that god, because, you know, you have to sort of be diplomatic about these things, and that the little g gods really only rule over their specific chunks of wherever. And, you know, I always think of the story of, you know, the Romans, when they occupied biblical Palestine, had offered to put up in the Pantheon a statue of the Jewish God. And, of course, the Jewish community became very upset and said, you can't make a statue of our God. It's not the same. It's not the same kind of God. It's not just a different God. It's a different idea. And so I think in that sense, the three faiths are certainly united in that this... in the idea of a universal God, a God that is not tied to a particular place, that is not bound by time. You know, it's not a harvest God or a moon God or this or that. And that, I think, certainly at the time that it was introduced, was a fairly radical idea, and continues in some senses to be a fairly radical idea. But sort of past that, you know, I sometimes wonder if all Muslims are worshiping the same God. Because we're kind of stuck in many cases on the "did Jesus laugh" argument, in the sense that there are huge ongoing arguments that are very acrimonious about whether references to, for example, God having hands are literal or metaphorical. And you get sort of the extremely literal interpretations of like the Wahhabis, which means if it's a hand, it's a hand, like we've got hands. And then you have the Mu'tazili interpretation, which is, no, it's just a metaphor. And then you have kind of the Ash'ari interpretation, which is where I am, which is, okay, the reason that the word hand is used is important, but there's no way it can mean hand, because that would mean that God resembled something created, which is heresy. So, I mean, like, there's still these... I sometimes wonder, and I talked to a Bohara, a Shia friend of mine, about this. I almost wonder if the reason that the younger generations are so focused on practice rather than the sort of like, oh, just be a good person, drink your Pinot Noir. I mean, I'm sorry, I keep coming back to the Pinot Noir. Because it's just that I think that sort of spiritual but not religious is deeply tied to sort of what we consume rather than what we believe. So I think the reason that those practices have become so important is because it's really the practices that unite us rather than the beliefs, even within a religion. And he said to me, my Bohara friend, they're a very small Shiite minority with some very interesting ideas. I'd always assumed that religion was the love between a believer and God. And he said, what if God is the love between a believer and religion? And that blew up my entire mind. And I said, whoa, it had like a Matrix moment. So I almost think that it blurring those lines may not be as helpful as we think. I think it's less important agreeing about what we believe than it is about agreeing how we practice, not even how we practice, but how we treat each other. That ethical commonality, I think, is the key. The theological stuff will be debated until kingdom come, literally.
Do you think that, another question, do you think that respect for minority religions has improved or gotten worse in Western societies over the past century?
I think there's not a straight straight line on that, because so much is related to how much fear is abroad, and how much it gets pushed. I mean, you know, the 50s looked like a high watermark for interfaith stuff, but it was fairly surface, if we're honest about it. And so, you know, when you get pushed a little bit on it, there may be more problems, but that may be the genesis of something better to come. You know? I would just like to say something further on what Willow was talking about, because I think we're back to this issue of forgetting when we're being literal. And yes, some people end up with literal and stay there. But I think that's the point at which you wrestle with, are we talking about the infinite or not? Someone asked the question, which is in front of me, objecting to my parable, and said, look, you know, some things are contradictory. The Quran says, Allah begotteth not. The Bible says, for God gave his only begotten son. Beginning is something human beings do. Are we made in God's image, or is God made in our image? I think as religion gets constructed, we almost can't help ourselves but make God in our image. And the minute we do it, we lose God. When Willow at one point said, is it literal or is it just a metaphor? I would only say that just a metaphor may not be quite there. I think metaphors are where it's at. It's not that I don't think what we can apprehend by our senses isn't real, but I think there is a reality in which metaphor resides where something transcendent is possible.
Yeah, I'm thinking about, you know, the one God question, which I don't have an answer for, but I'm thinking about it and what Willow was saying as well. And I'm wondering, what is the value of funneling down from that question? Because yes, it would be easier. Obviously, it would be easier if we all just agreed that everyone was worshiping the same God. But we don't. Now, we funnel down so that we can feel right. We funnel down so that we can lord that rightness over others. We funnel down for our own personal, to feel calm and to feel like, I have an answer. I know where I'm going. I know what this is all about. Those aren't necessarily good reasons, I think, to funnel down. But there are good reasons. And I'm wondering if it's because we have to somehow get closer to the infinite. And the one way to do that, it's a flawed way, but it's the only way we have, is through religion. And that is what's taking us to the process. Maybe what we then need to do is, once we get there, and that's going to be, as we've been talking about, a different answer for everyone, even if you attend the same church every Sunday, then we need to funnel out from that point and retrace our steps and take where we think we've come to, and allow at that point other journeys to be alongside us. And maybe that's where there's more value in diversity. So it's, we could maybe still get to the point where there's one God and we don't have all the answers, but we've been through this sort of self-reflective process that religion has taken us through, where we can feel a certain firmer connection with the infinite just by doing that, but not having to necessarily stop right there and lord it over everyone else.
You know, it's kind of like different poets. I mean, each of us who loves poetry doesn't necessarily like the same poets, and we don't get taken to the same place. So you read Eliot and I read Frost, and maybe you can't stand Frost, and maybe I just can't get Eliot, but I actually love Eliot. But it's okay. We really don't have to find some meta poet that satisfies both of us. I do think, you know, I've been talking about metaphor. But what Willow was talking about in terms of practice, each of us has to have some, put it in a Christian way, sacramental way of enacting our faith. For many, it is in a place of worship. Some enact their faith outside the place of worship, in the social sphere. But that enactment is an important part of how we express our faith in our own lives. It's really not critical that we all do it the same way. In fact, it seems to me critical that we don't.
A couple of questions asking for resources, and I'll read them all, and we can ask the panelists to. Someone is interested in, as we've been talking about the commonalities between Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, whether a particular author might be a good direction to go to understand that better. And then a couple of questions directly to Willow about the best places to go online for resources about interfaith discussion within Islam and information about Islam.
Oh, gosh. Online. First... I would love to recommend, I get a question a lot about, okay, I want to read the Quran, what do I do? There's a million different translations and they're all terrible, and yes, they're all terrible. But recently a new one has come out that I think is probably the most accessible to a non-Muslim audience and also has a great deal of commentary in the margins. It's called the Study Quran. It's edited by who? I'm going to forget. Anyway, but the people who edited it are all people whose expertise I trust, and in some cases who I've spoken to. It's gigantic. It's very intimidating looking, but most of that is just sort of commentary on the science. But it's when people ask me often, like, what do I do if I want to understand the Quran? I say, read the Bible first. because the Quran assumes fluency in biblical literature. It'll very briefly reference stories that it assumes you know already. In terms of online resources, oh my gosh.
Discussion groups, things like that.
Discussion groups. There are two websites that I think are good clearinghouses for various forms of Islamic belief in the West, and they are Alt-Muslim and Alt-Muslima. And they predate the alt-right. The alt was just at that point meant to reference, you know, the HTML command, because these are kind of older websites. But they're great. They have a good sort of diversity of sort of intra-Muslim dialogue. Alt-Muslim is sort of more broadly focused. Alt-Muslima, it focuses on women's issues in Islam. The authors are all Western Muslims of various backgrounds, Sunni and Shiite. And more secular and less secular. So those are good. You know, this is going to be very intimidating, but Twitter is a great place to get real, live, 24-hour discussions between thinkers of various stripes. I'm often in dialogue there with people like Reza Aslan, who is a host of the new show Believer on CNN, which explores the world, world religions. And, you know, various other people who are sort of in pop culture and in academia. So if you're not intimidated by Twitter, it's actually a really good place to go to see live those discussions happening between different groups. What was that? Spell it? The website? The book? I'm sorry, I can't hear. Alt-Muslim, yeah, altmuslim.com. We'll take you there.
And altmuslima.com.
Altmuslima.com, yeah. With an A.
Last, we have a classic World Affairs Conference and bolder question, and that is, in the 21st century, do we still need religion?
Well, I go back to how you began this. I'm not sure it matters if we answer that. It's going to be here.
I don't think we do. I think the answer is no, we don't need it. But I think it may need us, if that makes sense.
Well, I'll go to another question then, since we do have some time. We've talked a lot about interreligious diversity and diversity among religions. This is another kind of bolder question. How do we deal with religious diversity as science is becoming more important? And how do diverse religious positions relate to the emergence and the continued importance of science?
I would think that question presumes unnecessary divergence, and all one has to do is talk to scientists who are Muslims, Christians, Jews, etc., etc. And see that that's not the case. There's no necessary. If that was part of the question, I'm not sure.
Yeah, I think that's certainly there are people that there is a division for them between those two things, and it's very important to them, but I think that's also a perception that's been blown way out of proportion, especially in political dialogue, because scores of believers, as you said, are working, you know, diligently in scientific fields, as they always have been. This isn't a new question. This isn't something we're just encountering now, that science and faith, you know, sometimes butt heads, or at least how people hold those two things. So that suggests also it might not ever go away, but I think we can, you know, find encouragement and hold to those who don't see a conflict and are pursuing good work in both fields sometimes at the same time.
If the CWA was meeting at the turn of the 17th century, the same question was asked.
On that note, let's thank our panelists.